Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, energy bills will rise in January and expected to go up in April next year, with net zero targets partially to blame. In better energy news, though, could the end be nigh for hated standing charges? Also today, as more of us are opting to pay for Christmas with cash, over half of us say we've had trouble paying in notes and coins last year. So is it time for the government to step in? Plus, neighbourly disputes over fences, what's the best way to give money, and why Lee is continuing to hodl his premium bonds. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, we're not out of the cost of living woods just yet. Household energy bills will rise twice next year, at least, according to the oracles of this sort of thing at Cornwall Insight. The cap, currently at £1,717 a year, will rise to £1,738 from the 1st of January and is expected to go up again to £1,782 from April 2025. So, that's the bad news. The better news is that standing charges could be a thing of the past. The regulator is proposing that by next winter, energy firms will have to offer deals without it, currently priced at £388 for the average home, and you have to pay it. We will get more into that in a little while. But firstly, Lee, energy bills. What's the price cap briefly? Why is it going up?
The price cap is the limit set by Ofgem. It's the maximum amount of money that energy firms could charge for units of gas and electricity that we use. And it also limits how much households can pay in standard charges. So it sets all of these amounts. So you're not going to be paying that sum that you said just then, the £1,717. That's just the average home. So some people will be paying more than that if you're in a bigger home, for example. Some people will be paying under that. Now, we're not in the bad old days where the price cap, a couple of winters ago, we had that bleak time when we were paying, you know, plus £3,000 typically for this. It's fallen all back off from that. But there are some signs that next year this is going to be inching a little bit higher, up to that £1,782 in April compared to where we're at the moment, £1,717. Part of that is being told in this Cornwall Insight forecasting that it's to do with funding subsidies to energy firms to try and meet the government's net zero targets. So all of those things and schemes that we're hearing about, you know, more wind farms and all of that kind of thing, also to blame. So we could be looking at slightly higher energy bills and prices going up, nothing like what we had before. But of course, energy has been really in sharp focus this winter because of the winter fuel payment, for example, and the axing of that for pensioners, unless you're on pension credit. And essentially, people are kind of fed up with these higher energy bills. And part of that is the standing charges that we'll talk about shortly. But Cornwall Insight, just for kind of anyone that hasn't heard of them, they've been quite accurate at forecasting this this price cap over time. The price cap's actually 6 years old next month. Happy birthday, price cap. Feels like it's been around for ages. And it's just, again, a little bit worrying that we're seeing these energy bills ticking higher, and it's not the news that people want. You know, we kind of want to be seeing it going the other way. But at present, that's not where it's going.
It's not, Lee. Should you fix now, I think, is what a lot of people are thinking. Because what's going to happen after April and beyond? I mean, it's, looking at the state of the world at the moment, pretty hard to predict, I'd imagine.
Well, that's the thing as well, isn't it? Like I say, Cornwall Insight have been very accurate at predicting it, but they can't predict geopolitical things that could affect gas supply, for example. We're obviously trying to build, you know, less reliance on getting our source of energy from overseas, but that takes time. But there are some fixes out there, you're right. So we had a good couple of years where it was very difficult to go and find a fixed energy deal. Lots of us have been simply shunted onto variable tariffs because there was no fixes that were out there beating it. But I think one good bit of light at the end of the tunnel of all this energy crisis stuff is that we are seeing more fixes out there. In fact, we've relaunched our energy switching service, which we do in conjunction with U-Switch, which is a sign that actually things are potentially thawing out a little bit. We obviously have come off the back of all of those energy firms that went bust, some really big companies, millions of people being shunted into, you know, being gobbled up by the big players. But having a look here, it is possible to get a fix around about £1,600. And some of the companies are offering 18-month fixes. Some of them are offering 12-month fixes. So it's worth shopping around. It's worth having a look. It's worth seeing what your energy supply is currently offering. The crucial thing is to look at your energy bill, see how much you're paying per unit for gas and for electricity and for the standing charge, and how that's going to compare if you fix. Is it a lower rate or a higher rate? You want to have a look at exit fees, so in case you need to cancel, how much that's going to cost, because they can be quite chunky sometimes. There's a number of companies. I'm looking at this table here. There's Eon Next, Outfox the Market, EDF, British Gas, Octopus, Co-op, Sainsbury's. They're all offering fixed rate deals that are underneath the current price cap, and therefore will be also under any kind of rises in April.
Thank you, Lee. Simon, Lee there mentioned about there's fewer energy firms. I remember the time when it was, 30 or something went under. I mean, it was phenomenal. What's the picture like now, regulatory-wise as well? I mean, are they allowed to have... I mean, who described it? Was it you or Lee saying it was basically a two-bit effort in someone's bedroom and you could start up an energy firm? Sounds like something Lee would say. But either way, what is the picture looking like now, Simon, for the wider market?
The picture now for the wider market is, with every day that passes, we move closer to Octopus just being every single person in the country's energy supplier. It does certainly feel like that. I mean, Octopus has become one of the largest energy suppliers. And also, I must admit, I'm one of those people. I mean, why fight the inevitable?
Me too.
If they're going to take over everybody's energy, you might as well be a customer. And I actually think, as energy firms go, they are actually really quite good compared to the other energy firms I've been with. So, for example, because I have a smart meter, my bills are accurate. Both smart gas and electricity meters, so my bills are accurate, and I can go onto their site and I can geek out and have a look at stuff. So I can really, like, you know, drill into how much energy I'm using, what are the standing charges that people dislike so much, you know, all that kind of stuff. Go back through my bills, and it's a completely different experience to the ones I had with the legacy energy companies in the past, where they would just send you an estimated bill, or they'd expect you to do the work with the meter reading, or even if you did have a smart meter, somehow it would just, you still wouldn't get accurate bills, and so on. So I think that's quite good. The picture now is that there are much fewer energy companies than there were at the peak of energy mania, when, I mean, basically, I think it was just stuff being set up in people's bedrooms with some of these energy companies. And what they were doing was that they were effectively plugging into a system where they set up a business and a website and said, right, we'll sell you energy. And then they got plugged into the comparison sites with a low energy cost. And then they bought the energy on the market, and then they sold it to you. They just acted as a middleman, basically, between these two things. The margins were wafer thin and, in some instances, non-existent. And when energy prices spiked, because they were buying the energy on the wholesale markets, they had to pay the price on the wholesale markets. And all of a sudden, they had lots of customers who had locked into rates that were now lower than the ones they were having to pay for the energy. And we saw a wave of these companies going bust. I don't think that we're ever going to go back to that situation. I mean, like, councils were setting up their own energy firms. And I think at one point we joked about setting up a This Is Money energy firm.
Yeah,
just to,
we did.
Literally, I think it was, we were going to do it just to see how easy it was, to test out, you know, how easy would it be to set up a This Is Money energy firm? Luckily, we didn't, because This Is Money energy probably would have gone bust along with all the other energy companies. And then we would have had egg on our face. potentially a loss that we had to deal with and some creditors, and also would have been very difficult to take the moral high ground on the catastrophe that was the energy market if we'd actually set up our own energy company and then signed up some customers. Fortunately, we were never really going to do that. But
does that mean prices will never go back to where they were? Because I remember, Lee, didn't you get a deal or something just before all this happened for like 800 quid a year or something? But that was an average. Like, this was... Now you think, God, can you imagine getting that?
Just before Lee confirms the price of his energy deal or not, on that, prices could go back to where they were, only if energy prices go back to where they were. So gas and electricity, you know, are still really quite expensive compared to what they were. They're not as bad as they were in the spike, but you've got to see a scenario where, you know, the Russia problem sorts itself out probably. You get a lot less geopolitical strife. People calm down and stop trying to stockpile gas. And maybe also we remove some of the pressure from the green endeavours, which actually probably isn't a very good idea. So maybe they won't. What you probably won't go back to is a scenario which Mr. Boyce can fill us in a moment on exactly what he was paying and how cheap it was, but where you're able to buy energy for less than the cost of energy, which is, I think, what was going on with some of these companies.
Yeah, I was paying about that, but it really had fallen to a point where I was like, this is criminally cheap.
Too good.
It's too good. And actually, I'm gonna talk about my energy bill again in a minute when we talk about standing charges. Because
Well, Lee, talk about standing charges.
Okay, well, that segues us nicely into standing charges.
Yeah, doesn't it?
The standing charges are, I would say, in one of the top 10 sort of buzz trigger words for our readership. You know, if you're going to write a story about standing charges, the reader comments goes absolutely crackers. People will email in. They're fed up of standing charges that have gone up a lot in recent years. Now, I'm going to swing this back around to my own energy. I'm going to call it an energy journey, Georgie, which sounds like some sort of like, spin, some marketing spin, my energy journey. I was a customer of First Utility. I then got shunted over to Shell Energy when Shell Energy took that over. And I've now been shunted over to Octopus, as Simon says, seems to be taking over everyone's energy a little while back when Shell decided to exit. Now, the reason why I mention that is because I did a piece not so long ago where I looked back at standing charges, because when I was still at Shell Energy, I could look back at historic bills. So I don't have paper bills, you know, endless paper bills around the house. This was just me logging into my account, and I could go back over the years. And I was interested to know how much my standing charge had gone up. That part of the bill that seamlessly, it seems to have just been going up and up. And essentially what it is the charge of getting, your energy supply, you know, being connected to electricity and gas to your home, right? I worked out that when it comes to electricity, my standing charge was up 192.8% in 7 years.
Wow.
Which absolutely incredible. And my gas was up 79%. And I worked out that inflation up until that point where I wrote this, it was last year when I wrote this, but it was up 31.8%. So way above inflation, these standing charge rises. That's what people are fed up of. They feel like it's just a cash cow. They feel like this is just constantly going up. And when this Ofgem price cap gets announced, it feels like the standing charge is just constantly either jumping or inching higher every time that this gets announced. And there's nothing you can do about it. And actually, I didn't realise until this week that it has gone up to the average home, £388 is now standing charge. That's a hefty amount.
That's what it would be to connect you to a home, or is that an average?
It is an average, because around the country it does vary a little bit. It's not just...
But it's nothing to do with your usage, so you can stop using as much energy as you want to save money, but you're still going to have to pay...
Yeah,
average,
which is
400 quid,
which is where the grumble comes from, because if you are someone that's say single and living in a home, and you've cut your energy usage right down to the bone,
goodness,
there's nothing you can do about the standing charge. And you know, there's other scenarios in which this can come into play, which I know Simon had a big bugbear about this recently.
I can confirm that there is a scenario where you still manage to pay for energy even though you're not using it. Because last year, while we were building a house or rebuilding our house, we had our gas disconnected, and I'm looking at my bill from August to September last year, and we paid £8.53 in total for gas. The gas wasn't actually connected at the time, so that's just standing charges.
Wow. So people were fed up with it. People are kind of thinking this is getting blindly going up. They feel like it's lining the pockets of the energy firms. They feel like this is money that's going to things that's sort of out of their control, including the failure of energy firms that we were just talking about. So now, and there's been calls for this for quite a while, Ofgem has come out this week and said that from next winter, energy firms will need to offer deals that do not have standing charges. So currently there are a few deals out there. They're incredibly rare. The trade-off with these deals is that the unit rate, so the price of electricity and the price of gas, is a little bit higher. The devil will be in the detail when these get launched next year. But for some people, they might end up making sense, because if you can withdraw £388 from your bill, and you are using a minuscule amount of gas and electricity, perhaps your home is really energy efficient. As I say, perhaps you're solo, you know, you're likely to be using way less than a typical home. And it will give households choice. And actually, Tim Jarvis, the Director General of Markets at Ofgem, said many people feel very strongly that standing charges are unfair. We want to give consumers the ability to make the choice that's right for them without putting any one group of consumers at a disadvantage. So it sounds like this is going to come in next year. I can't imagine it's going to be that difficult to implement. What will be difficult to work out is whether you're going to be better off on one of these deals or not. The real crunching of numbers on this will be the unit rates versus unit rates on a standing charge deal. But positive nonetheless. I think it's good innovation and good that there'll be more choice.
I think it's interesting that they're looking at it, but I'm just curious as to how they might work this out, what the implications for the price cap would be. Would you need two separate price caps? Because you'd imagine that all bills will go up slightly more, because, I mean, the very nature of the standing charge is, you know, presumably to pay for maintenance. That maintenance and investment still needs to happen. They need to get that money from somewhere. I like the idea that it should be based on your usage, and if you are sort of reducing it, then, you know, that's a bit fairer. But I'm just wondering whether we'd have sort of like a, I hate using two-tier, I feel like we're using it all the time at the moment. Do you know what I mean? How would they work out the maths on this, and what would that mean for the price cap?
But I think if the standing charge, and I must say, I often find it quite amusing how vexed people get by standing charges, right? As Lee said, it drives people absolutely nuts. I'm like, well, your energy bill's your energy bill ultimately at the end of the day, and you're not going to end up paying less, and it's not really that much. Although when you look at your bill, you know, it's not that much over the course of a month. So currently on my most recent bill, standing charge 31 days, £8.67 for gas, standing charge for electricity £14.40. But then when you look at the cost over a year, it adds up to £271. And you're like, okay, yeah, £271 is quite a lot of money. But if the standing charge is for, you know, the network, all these other things, etc., why is it based on a price per unit? You know, why does it go up or down with the cost of the energy? Maintaining the network doesn't go up and down with the cost of the energy. Maintaining the gas network and the electricity grid is not affected by whether gas or electricity is cheap or expensive at the moment. I mean, it is affected by other things. You know, it's not a constant cost, but it's not, you know, just because Vladimir Putin decides to invade Ukraine and sends gas prices spiking doesn't mean it costs more to maintain the pipes. So I can see where people are coming from here, and maybe it would just be better to just get rid of them altogether and just build it into people's bills. But as you said, I can't see a scenario where it ends up with people paying less. You know, but it does mean that what you're paying for is what you use, rather than you paying for this sort of nebulous concept and then paying for what you use. And I think that's what really annoys people, is the whole, you know, they're like, even if I got my use down to zero, I'd still be paying, which, as I confirmed earlier, does actually happen. People aren't going to get their use down to zero, but you know.
I guess it's one of those sort of like sneaky things. So this sort of goes full circle a little bit, because you know, people want to know where their money's going, and they want to know that if they're paying for something, it sort of reminds me of insurance premium tax. Sort of like, I want to pay for my insurance. I don't want to pay for some sort of tax on top of it. Or I want to pay for the energy I use. I don't want to pay for some standing charge. But then this goes to what Lee mentioned earlier about these net zero policies in our bills. Now, that's one of the reasons that they're sort of going up. And people are looking at that going, well, I don't have a say over that, because it's not on the, I mean, what they're using and what they're paying. So it's like, why is that included into our bills?
I mean, people don't have much of a say over the latest wizard plan from our new government to build a load of really crap quality houses and allow big developers to make out like bandits.
Yeah,
I mean, that true. Was the thing that was definitely missing from any of these announcements this week, or anything that Angela Rayner has said on it, is the who's going to build these houses, and are they actually going to be of a decent quality and going to be cheaper than the new houses that get built now? Because I think, you know, if you want to build a load of new houses, then you need to take the public with you. And it appears to me like they're taking the developers with them, but they ain't taking the public with them. But to go back to the energy thing, yeah, it's the same thing. I think we just seem to have completely abandoned the taking the public with us bit of net zero, and it's become an imposing something on the public, when arguably, you know, shifting away from dirty energy to clean energy, which actually could prove to be more reliable and leave us less reliant upon foreign powers that we don't necessarily agree with, is probably a good thing. But the way it's somehow ended up being framed is lots of people see it as an assault on their very basic rights as a human being, when it's like, actually, getting energy from the sun rather than from, you know, digging up the ground is probably a really good idea, and polluting the air and so on. But it just astonishes me, really, because we definitely initially did have the kind of this is a good thing argument going on. If you go back, you know, 10, 15 years, and we seem to have now, it's just turned into this is a bad thing and we're all being ripped off kind of scenario. Apart from obviously people who are really committed to the climate, of which many people listening to this will be, but they will also know from the conversations that they have with people, about 80% of people are just like, sod that.
Is this the best way through our energy bills to fund the net zero kind of campaign? Where is private equity in all this, and investment and climate finance? I thought that there was still some momentum there. While we may have sort of dropped off a little bit on, especially with Trump, you know, coming back in, Trump 2.0 and all that sort of jazz. What is the best way to fund these projects?
You've got to be careful about that, though. I mean, potentially, arguably, the best way to fund these projects would be for the state to fund them in some way, because unless you set up very good guardrails for private finance and investment finance, you can find a scenario where you have very smart financiers and business people taking advantage of people a bit. At the moment, there is a rush to put solar panels on fields. And there are companies going around approaching farmers and saying, put some solar panels on your fields, we'll give you some money. And it's easier to get through the planning system than trying to put other things on fields. And, you know, Bob's your uncle, everyone's a winner, and so on. But where a lot of these places are being suggested, there's a backlash from local residents, because the solar farms are absolutely huge. And quite often you see them, they want to put them next to, you know, a footpath or a bit of the countryside that people enjoy. Or it's just because it's a convenient place to put it on the field and so on. I've always wondered, why don't we do this down the side of the motorways, on the fields down the side of the motorways? We've already ruined those fields. They've got a motorway running through them. That, to me, would seem to be the obvious place to do it. Now, I do understand that what you also need to do is you need to put them in a place where you can actually actively connect them to the grid. You know, there are lights on the motorways, aren't there? There's, you know, power near the motorways. It can't be that difficult, can it, to go, do you know what? Actually, if we are going to do this, let's do this in a smarter way. The other issue with the finance thing is that there's quite a few renewable energy investment trusts, and they were very, very popular when interest rates were very low, because they offered a yield. In many cases, they were getting payments from the governments that rose with inflation and so on. And so they offered a kind of guaranteed income, and you could pick up a, you know, 5-6% income from some of these investment trusts. And when interest rates were at 0.5%, that looked great. You know, government bond yields at 1%. That looked really good. As interest rates have risen and government bond yields have risen, you've got to the point where you could get as much from a risk-free government bond, you know, from a gilt, or you could get it from, you know, and as an individual, you get it from a savings account and so on. And so all of a sudden, these investment trusts started to look a lot less attractive to people, and they've sold off heavily, and a lot of them are trading at a big, big discount. I mean, there's potentially an investment opportunity there for people, because as interest rates start to come down, the yields on those trusts is going to look more interesting. But it gives an example of why the private finance thing doesn't always work. And we don't have an amazing record of not getting mugged off by private finance initiatives in this country. So I think you need to set the guardrails in place. But if you do set the guardrails in place, then maybe that it does work. What I actually think would be a better idea is to target all of the money that people, individual savers, are sitting on. So we've got, you know, a lot of people in this country with a lot of money in savings. What they want is a pretty solid, regular return on their money. We've got people with big, you know, pension pots, for example, defined contribution pension pots. If you can create something that provides a steady stream of income and is government backed, for example, you know, renewable energy, and it then gives the government the funding in order to go off and do these renewable energy products, well, maybe that's not a bad idea.
I love that I can throw any old question at you, Simon, and unfazed. Beautiful. All right, cash use is on the up. It accounted for nearly one in every five retail transactions last year. That's according to data from the British Retail Consortium, accounting for 19.9% of transactions, up from 18.8% in 2022. It comes as half of Britons say they've had trouble paying with cash in the last year, according to new research from your sister publication, Money Mail. Just firstly, before we get into this, when was the last time we used cash? Lee?
I've used cash this week for definite, because I always withdraw money at payday and I keep it in my wallet and spend it as the week's gone on. I'll tell you where I spent it. I was at my daughter's school Christmas fete on Saturday. And even though the school has moved to try and get us to QR code absolutely everything when it comes to payments, I had cash and paid for all the little stalls and things in cash.
Right. Mine was the end of September, and it was euros on holiday. I cannot remember the last time I used British money. I will probably give someone cash for Christmas. Simon?
I used some cash the other day. I took some cash out of the machine, and I used it for something, but I can't remember what it was. But I know I had to go get some cash out of the machine to use on something. Oh, I know. I had to pay for parking with cash.
Oh, wow.
We had to take our daughter to a hospital appointment for root canal surgery, the poor thing, in London. And so we drove up and parked nearby. And this car park only takes cash. You can't pay with the card. So,
So cash use is up. Is this due to budgeting? Is this due to a result of COVID restrictions being lifted? Because, of course, the two rises that we've seen, the consecutive years, last year and the year before, obviously since the COVID restrictions were lifted. So what's it down to, Lee?
So we've got two different reports here, Georgie. So the first one, this British Retail Consortium one, saying that pretty much one in five transactions now are in cash, up from 18.8% in 2022. But we have to go back a decade on these stats and look back at 2013, 2014, where basically half of all transactions were cash, which is an incredible drop-off to where we're at today. COVID was the big, big reason that we saw a big drop-off. All that nonsense about, you know, it was not clean to use cash, and oh my word, honestly, it drove me all round the bend. Absolute nonsense. The reason that the BRC are kind of pointing to here is that a lot of people are using it to budget more, finding it easy to budget. That's why I take cash out on a payday. You know, I'm not necessarily on a hugely strict budget, but I kind of like to know that I've got that money to spend on things that I want to do, things, you know, coffees and whatnot, if I can find a coffee shop that will take cash now, which we'll get to in a sec. But I kind of like having that cash in my wallet. And one of the big reasons for that is technology fails. How often have we seen shops where they haven't been able to take car payments, or there's been a bank outage or whatever? I think it's always just nice just to have some cash in your wallet. It's there, and I think a lot of people do still feel that way. I use my card way more than I use cash. I use contactless payments way more than I use cash. This isn't me saying I just pay for everything exclusively in cash. It's good to have the choice.
Stay off the grid, Lee.
Yeah, stay off the grid and all that kind of stuff. Actually, to be honest, though, Georgie, I do kind of like that little bit of spending off the grid. You know, I think it's kind of nice just to still have cash and kind of not having it come up on a bank app saying you've spent £4 in Costa and this and that and the other. I just don't really like that much. You know, it's good to have some off-grid spending. Now, that goes hand in hand with some figures from Link, which is the network of ATMs. Basically, their survey suggesting there's been a 22% increase from 2023 in the locations that did not accept or discouraged the use of cash this year. And in the survey, the number one place where people were kind of fed up with it, car parks. Which goes nicely just back to Simon's point, where he said he could only pay with cash. Lots of car parks have gone app only, drives a lot of people around the bend. Because while lots of us have smartphones and we're used to doing it, we have to understand that not absolutely everyone in this country has a smartphone, has internet access in their pocket. You know, they want to go to a car park, they want to pay for like £1, £2, £3 car park in cash. And one of the things that drives me nuts is when you go to a car park and it is just app only and you've got to sign up for the app, you might have patchy mobile signal. And the thing that really drives me nuts is like, it's a £2 car park transaction and then the bank wants to send me a one-time passcode and I have to do all of that for a £2 car park. By the time I've done that, it's like 5 minutes of faffing around where I could have just been out spending and doing stuff. Then one in five are saying that they've been to a cafe and restaurant this year that hasn't taken cash. And then public transport and pubs, one in 10 people are saying that. And, you know, 59% of people saying it caused an inconvenience this year, an increase from 48% last year. So there's obviously been a push, and it all did come, a lot of it did come from the pandemic. You know, we are no longer accepting cash, contactless payment, you know, car payments, contactless payments only. But it's not fail safe. And, you know, I've seen it even this year where it's gone down and then all of a sudden it's like, well, I do have cash. And then, you know, we don't take cash. So I find it absolutely baffling that a business would choose to not accept a payment option that's been around for thousands and thousands of years. It kind of baffles me, and I think it baffles a lot of the general public, and I think that cash use will continue to stay relatively steady.
Really, banks and building societies, they're ever driving harder for it. Governments, it's a great way for them to see what we're doing. It's good for tax revenue. Businesses, it's cheaper, isn't it? Because there's a real problem with, you know, the amount of money that's lost through using cash. So why will it stay?
Use it or lose it, Georgie. It's that mentality of, I think people go, if I stop using this and everyone stops using this, it's going to disappear as an option altogether. And I think that when you start backing people into a corner like that, I think that's when people go and sort of stand up a little bit and go, hold on a minute. No, I do actually quite like cash. As I said to you, it does not make up a huge number of transactions that I make on a monthly basis, but it at least makes up some of the transactions that I make on a monthly basis. And I think that's key. And actually, when I saw that it was sort of 20% of people were using cash as their sort of number one option, I would say probably 10 to 20% of my everyday spending on a monthly basis is cash. And I reckon there's quite a lot of people out there in the same way. Don't dislike card payments, but dislike the thought of losing payment option.
I'm terrible at this stuff, actually. Mm-hmm. As much as I know that, you know, Rachel from accounts and Andrew from the bank would dearly love me to use cards all the time so that they can monitor my spending and control it more. I am absolutely terrible at using cash, and I reckon 5% maximum of my monthly spending, 3% perhaps, is cash. I mean, I get cash out and then it just sits in my wallet. But shout out to Helen Crane here for her own take on the cash spending scenario this week, which was, she went to buy a Christmas tree, got some cash out to pay for the Christmas tree in advance, then discovered that she could pay on a card, so paid on a card. And she said, there's nothing more annoying than when you end up with a load of cash because you've taken cash out because you think you need it to pay for something, and then actually you can pay on a card. And so you use the card and then you've got a load of cash sitting there.
Lee, wafting cash around there. Lee, I've got absolutely nothing to offer. I've got some old receipts in my wallet, a lot of loyalty cards. Final one on this one, though. Do you think governments need to step in? Mail Money looked into this and found that half of Britons say they have trouble paying with cash, which means those people presumably want to pay with cash. That's why they're having trouble, because they identify that they're having an issue with it. So is it time that governments do step in? Like we're seeing in other countries around, I think Sweden stepped in recently and sort of is encouraging people to hodl their cash.
Well, they have stepped in a little bit because we've had a bit of a shift in kind of stance in a few months ago. Treasury Select Committee opened an inquiry calling for evidence to determine if new rules were needed to make cash acceptance mandatory across Britain. That's quite serious because if you do that, you have to have all of the infrastructure behind it and moving all of the money around, you know, those big Securitas vans and all that kind of stuff, and having the depots and having banks that you can pay your daily takings into and all of that kind of thing. When you start making something mandatory, though, is when I kind of then start to lose the plot a bit, because at the end of the day, a business is a business and it can choose to do what it wants, even though I'm quite hard and I think that it's good that we can, it's good for businesses to accept all payment options. I'm also in the mindset of it's a free world. You can go and do what you want. And if you don't want to take cash anymore or you don't want to take card anymore, that's your prerogative as a business owner. And if you as a consumer don't like it, don't use it. It's not an essential service. If it is an essential service, there's lots of different things to consider about this. But government meddling, government mandatory, government, you got to do this, makes me switch off and go, this is not what it's all about. It's about improving the infrastructure and it's about ensuring that we've got fair choice for everyone in this country and the way they spend.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, I have a question here from a listener. My fund investments are up this year, but nowhere near as much as the US stock market. Should I rethink my approach?
It's a good question, Lee. US stocks have been a hard benchmark to beat for the last couple of years. That growth has really come from a few top performing stocks, the Magnificent Seven, Apple, Alphabet, Amazon, you know, those names that people will be familiar with. Investment pros would have found it hard to beat that benchmark or any single top performing market in a single year. So what I would say is it doesn't represent good diversification. You would really be invested in the tech sector in the US. And if your strategy is sound and well diversified, I would stick with it. You really don't want to be flying on sort of one engine of performance. But yeah, the American stocks have really been doing well for a couple of years.
Other than the US, is it just good to have a blend around the world globally, or what are your views on that?
It can be good to sort of have some sort of view to take a judgment on different sectors and what will be better, and also to think about how much risk you want to take. Emerging markets are more risky, but you can beat the market with emerging markets. It's not an index, but it's hard to beat an index. And also some people have thought they've been well diversified in a global tracker, but in actual fact, they're also getting sucked into US tech stocks because those are becoming bigger and bigger parts of those trackers as well.
Brilliant. Lisa, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lee.
Welcome back. Read a question time about fences and neighbours. Always a popular one on This Is Money. I woke up, not me, reader, on Sunday morning to find four fence panels bordering the left-hand side of my garden had been blown down as a result of Storm Dara. I've asked my next-door neighbour to split the repair job 50-50, but he flat-out refused, saying it isn't their responsibility to sort it out or pay for it. First, he tried to claim that because it's on the left-hand side of my garden and the right-hand side of his, Simon shaking his head there, by the way, it is my responsibility. And then he had the cheek to say, I like this one, that it wasn't his problem because I fixed the fence the last time it blew down several years ago, and therefore the new fence is my fence, not his. Is it true that if I replaced the fence panels a few years ago when they blew down, because my selfish neighbour refused to help that time as well, that I am now legally responsible? If not, is there anything I can do? Simon, shaking your head there.
There's a number of, you know, urban legends, myths about fences. The idea that the one on the left is always yours or the one on the right is always yours. The idea that the last person to fix it is responsible for it. Fortunately, we do not operate on that principle in this country. Is responsible for it. Is that all? Those are all wrong. Basically, what you need to do is you need to check your title deeds. You can obtain a copy from the land registry if you don't have them to hand. What you want to look for are T marks on the boundary. If there is a T mark on the inside of the boundary, then it will show that it's your boundary. If there is a T mark on both sides of the boundary, then it will show that it's a party boundary and maintenance is a joint responsibility. And if maintenance is a joint responsibility, then you and your lazy neighbour need to both sort out the fence. But if the fence is actually your careless neighbour's responsibility, then your careless neighbour needs to sort it out. And if it turns out that it's your responsibility, then you need to go be nice to your neighbour and apologise and say, sorry, actually, I've discovered it's my friend's and would you like a cup of tea? And we'll make that and not fall out and end up in a ruinously expensive neighbourly dispute, of which my favourite neighbourly dispute of the day is the story I'm reading on the Mail Online homepage at the moment about the couple who bought a dream home and then discovered a bridal way ran straight through the middle of it.
Lee?
When I first moved into our house in 2016, the first weekend we was here, there was a big storm and it blew the fence down on the left-hand side. It was about two or three panels that had gone. And I remember meeting my neighbour pretty much for the first time, both in dressing gowns. It was a bit like that scene from Men Behaving Badly when he goes out in the storm in his dressing gown. We were like, okay, I was like, look, I'll get it sorted. I just moved in, I was like, I'll get it sorted. So I got it sorted, paid for it. There was no talk of splitting the cost or anything. I just sorted it out because I thought it would be a good neighbourly thing to do having just moved in. I then checked the title deeds and I was a new homeowner. I'd not even really thought about it. And then I checked the deeds and actually it turns out that the left-hand side as you exit my back door is actually that neighbour's responsibility and I'm responsible for the right-hand side fence. So I ended up needlessly paying for the fence. But we're good friends now. The fence has held true ever since, and I just waved the title deed.
Well,
this is your job.
Sometimes, if you want to get something fixed, you do just have to take responsibility for fixing it.
Exactly.
So yeah. I was going to say, is that just what this comes down to? Is just in the luck of the neighbourly draw, you hope you've got some decent neighbours.
Fences are really expensive, though.
No doubt.
Doing fencing now is it's quite expensive, so you can see why people want to do this. The worst one is when it's shared with the council. Trying to get the council to do anything is an absolute nightmare. I've ended up paying to replace a falling down wall with some railings in our flat because the house next door was owned by the council and honestly just trying to even get them to engage was impossible. In the end, we just paid for a new fence.
Also, can I just point out that fences also make the top 10 list of buzz themes and words for us, of people that get very irate, angry, and like reading stories about them.
Right, another reader question, but this time it's all about pensions, inheritance tax, and gifting. So bear with me on this one. My wife and I have built up a significant amount in several defined contribution pensions. We're fortunate enough to also have two defined benefit pensions, plus our state pensions, which are more than enough, as it sounds like it, to provide a very comfortable retirement. So basically, defined contribution pensions, they planned to be passed on to their daughters, except in a case of extreme emergency. But now things have changed as a result of the recent budget. So they say we've decided to take our 25% tax-free lump sums and to draw down the remainder of our pensions over the next 10 years to minimise income tax. Does this money count, they're asking, as excess income, out of which, of course, they can give it to their daughters free of inheritance tax as they pay it? They are in the 60s and 70s, in good health, and expect to outlast the 7-year rule. But obviously, Simon Lambert, the excess income is a favourable route just in case the worst case scenario. So lots to unpick here. But first, what was announced in the budget? What's excess income and what is the 7-year rule?
What was announced in the budget is that pensions will now form part of people's estates for inheritance tax, whereas previously they did not. They fell outside of your estate. They are also taxed when you die anyway. If you die after the age of 75, the median life expectancy in this country is over 75. So that, in theory, most pensions would be taxed. But if people die before 75, they can be inherited tax-free. After 75, income tax is imposed on the beneficiaries when they take the money out. This has created a potential double taxation scenario where inheritance tax would be charged on people's pensions and then income tax charged on people drawing the money out if the person who died was over 75. There's a consultation going on at the moment. You would sincerely hope that the government irons out that bit because that's clearly unfair. I'm not holding my breath owing to the fact that nobody appears to have the conviction to sort out our mess of a tax system. There is another problem in which basically in order to get at pensions, people are going to have to now go through probate. So even in a scenario where there is no inheritance tax to pay, for example, because a spouse is inherited, they're going to have to go through probate. All the pension valuations are going to need to come in. Some pension companies are nice and quick. Some take forever to do things. And as Steve Webb has pointed out, this is going to move at the pace of the slowest donkey. Steve didn't use the word slowest donkey. I'm using the word slowest donkey. Steve's nicer than that. But it is going to move at the pace of the slowest donkey. And you could find a scenario where people are waiting to get to pensions that they need the income for just because some useless life company is taking forever to deliver the information, or some useless other company as well. But because they now form part of people's inheritance tax liabilities, anybody who has been sitting on large defined contribution pensions in the thought that they could pass that on tax-free if they died before the age of 75, obviously don't try to die before the age of 75 to avoid tax. Dying is never a win. Yep. Are now thinking, whoa, we need to get rid of this pension. The problem with getting rid of your pension and giving it away is you get taxed when you take it out. You can get 25% of it tax-free, but the rest of it will be taxed. And if you start trying to take out more than a certain amount, you're going to be a higher rate taxpayer. You're going to be paying 40% tax, and therefore you're not going to be gaining anything on the inheritance tax. So it's all a bit confusing and a bit of a muddle. In this scenario, the couple are trying to give it away. They do have what would seem to be surplus income. Surplus income is something that gets you around the 7-year rule. 7-year rule is that you can give money away in order to avoid inheritance tax, but you have to survive 7 years for it to fall out of your estate and be completely free of inheritance tax. It actually works on a sliding scale. So if you survive for 3 years, for example, then the tax rate starts to come down. An exemption exists for this where you can give away regular sums of money from surplus income. There are a couple of things that these gifts must do to qualify for these conditions. Regularity, so they should form a pattern. Doesn't have to be monthly, interestingly. Could be annual. Doesn't even necessarily have to be annual, although exactly how you establish a pattern if something isn't annual, I'm not quite sure. Source of income, they must be made from your regular income, not your capital or your savings. Really grey area here, because if it's your defined contribution pension pot, which is therefore meant to provide you with income for your retirement, and this is the reason why the government is saying that they're pulling it into the inheritance tax thing, because it shouldn't be used in inheritance tax dodge, it should be used for your income in retirement. If you start drawing more from that, is that income? Is that capital? You know, it is a grey area.
Yeah.
But obviously, you need, if you're going to do this, I would say speak to a financial advisor as well. And no adverse effect. It means you shouldn't. It shouldn't adversely affect your own standard of living. So as long as you can clear all of those hurdles, then it is a very good way to give money away and keep it outside of the inheritance tax net. But do keep very detailed records because your executors are going to need them, because they're going to need to prove that you gave that money away out of your surplus income. And actually, do you know what? Best case scenario, you don't even need it because you survived for 7 years anyway.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Lee, last week we recorded the 10-year anniversary episode. I'm saying that like you might have forgotten it. Hopefully you haven't. It was the 10-year anniversary episode of This Is Money podcast. We were in front of a live audience. We talked about premium bonds. You joked that you were hodling them, which is, by the way, short for hold on for dear life, a slang term popular in the crypto world. Two obviously very different products there. But Lee, now I know you've not had the greatest success with premium bonds of late, but I was rather shocked to hear that you have not earned a penny in 2.5 years. And despite the news that the rates are dropping again, or the average PIE's payout rate is dropping again, the third cut since March, you are still holding on for dear life.
I'm holding on for dear life, Georgie. Yes, two different, very, very, very different products.
Yeah.
You know, crypto, incredibly volatile. Premium bonds at the moment, just about the least volatile thing I've got in my portfolio because it's not doing anything. I mean, you could argue that it's volatile in the fact that my wealth's being eroded away from inflation because I'm not getting a consistent return or a return whatsoever. So I've been involved in premium bonds for about 2.5 years. I hold just about in and around the average, which is £5,250. That's across all of the millions of people that hold them. Lots of people obviously max them out, £50,000. In fact, nearly 1.2 million people have 50 grand in them. Lots of people have less than 100 quid in them. Some of those bought as far back as the late 1950s when premium bonds first came out. So you would, you know, I was kind of been deliberating. I saw that we obviously wrote about the next cut. I thought about, come on, you moron, to sell these. What are you doing? You know, you're not getting a return on them. But I'm not going to sell them. I'm not going to sell out because fundamentally it gives you that monthly thrill of, in my case, 2.5 years of we've won nothing. And I can't wait until the day, hopefully, where I get a
you
message.
Get a million.
You've won something. Yeah, maybe I'm just going to win big. And that, but that completely like hits the home the point is that is why I'm sticking around in them. You only have to look through the stats though to know that really it's only the people with really big amounts that are going to probably win. That's just odds, that's just mathematics, that's just the way it goes. And we were crunching through the data of the last draw last week, which was if the average person that won £100,000 in the December draw had a holding of £41,141. The average winner of a £50,000 prize, £40,813. I went back, crunched all the £1 million winners over the past 12 months. The average holding, £36,949. Won a million. No one with a holding under 10 grand has won the jackpot this year. And 9 of the £24 million winners hold the maximum of £50,000. So that gives a clear picture that, you know, and you can see why it feels you've got to have huge sums in this in order for it to now make any kind of sense. But even with the amount that I hold in it, you know, with average luck over a year, I should have won some sort of prize, but haven't. Been a lot going around this week about, you know, essentially premium bonds are a great product if you've maxed out your ISA, your £20,000 annual allowance, and you are saving, you've got pensions, you've got investments everywhere else, because you can put the full amount, £50,000, and just park it in there. You've got the government guarantee, you get tax-free prizes, all crucial parts of your financial planning. So it's almost a no-brainer to park that 50K in there if you're so fortunate enough to have that kind of money. What there's been a lot of talk about this week is there's no point of having under £1,000 in premium bonds, which I completely understand the reasoning behind that. And indeed, if you are someone that's starting off in a kind of financial journey, premium bonds probably aren't going to be the right fit for you. You'd be better off getting into a regular saver, snowballing that, getting some opening up a stocks and shares ISA, making sure that your pension's all sorted. I'm already ticking all of those boxes. So I kind of, this is like almost like, it's not a bit of fun because finance is never fun, but it is my kind of bit of money there where it's like
people like it, Lee.
Yeah. And you know, you put five grand into a savings account, you know, over the course of the year, you're not going to be earning big bucks interest on that. Would be better to be getting some sort of interest on that rather than the 0% that I'm currently getting. but I'm comfortable with it because I have money spread around elsewhere and it just makes up a small fraction of my portfolio. But there is one scenario in which I think that it is okay to have less than £1,000 in premium bonds, and that's saving for children. Now, some financial experts will disagree with this and say, well, you'd be better off putting it into a junior ISA, you'd be better off putting it into a stocks and shares ISA, or putting it somewhere else, not the premium bonds, not 50 quid dribs and drabs. It ain't going anywhere. But listen, I still think it's a better scenario doing that. Speaking of my own household, and you've probably heard me say this on the podcast before, we're at peak stuff. We need no more stuff. I do not need any more plastic rubbish in this house. You know, and then you get the grandparents and family and friends and all the generous people saying, you know, what does your child want for Christmas? And it's kind of like, even my six-year-old saying she doesn't want anything for Christmas. I think even she's like at peak stuff. And I think that grandparents and family members can get their head around premium bonds more so than putting it into an investment account or into a junior ISA, because they feel like that money going somewhere that gives them a chance, very, 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 very small chance of winning a life-changing amount of money or a decent sum of money. So while you could argue that it's not that great to have, it's still, for me, it's still a better option. And that's just my own personal opinion. You might think I sound like the Grinch. You might think you're going, oh, it's Christmas, just get the kids all the toys that they want in the world. That's fine. That's your kind of, you know, your prerogative. But I think it's a good Christmas present. I think it's a good thing. And it has been since the dawn of premium bonds being around. I think what a lot of people grumble about, and I say this in the column, you know, I've realised that premium bonds are like the weather. Like, we do love to grumble about premium bonds. And when we did the 10-year show last week, lots of listeners wanted to talk about premium bonds and wanted to tell me their stories and their friends of a friend. You know, I had a friend of a friend this year who won 50 grand. And it's that little bit of hope, like a football fan.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it kills you. You kind of keep holding on. You think your form's going to turn or something's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it inevitably doesn't, or it definitely doesn't in my case as a Southend fan.
I was going to say, does that mean we're hodling Derby County and Southend? One day, Lee.
Basically,
one day.
Yeah, I'm just hodling. One day, it's going to go to the moon, but probably not. So that's why I'm hodling my premium bonds. Right. Whether or not you're hodling your premium bonds, again, that's your decision. And I would just, it's just that classic, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And I do know that there is I don't do TikTok, but I know there is a bit of a phenomenon on social media, including TikTok, where there's lots of people that will post their premium bond stories and wins and yada, yada, yada. And that can encourage younger people to go and plow all their money into premium bonds because they see it as a kind of risk-free lottery, so to speak. But there is a risk, and the risk is that your money's not moving, it's staying
2.5 years of not winning anything.
2.5 years of not winning, but I can take that risk because I'm doing everything else right financially, and you know, where else am I going to potentially win £1 million?
Fair, Lee. And finally, it's Simon's stat of the week. This week it is Simon.
Okay, the stat of the week is the average 2-year fixed rate mortgage, according to MoneyFacts, is currently 5.4685%. So 5.47%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you think that's higher or lower than it was a year ago?
Lower? But yes. I reckon it's higher.
It's lower. It's good. The good news is that a year ago, it's 5.98%. So even though mortgage rates have moved up recently, it is actually higher than it was a year ago. And two stats for the price of one this week. The average savings rate on a standard no notice account, 2.91%. Whereas a year ago, that was 3.17%. So that
that's
is
definitely lower.
Yeah. But just to say, if you are getting paid 2.91% on your savings, move them.
Yeah.
There are much better deals out there. You can easily get 4% or more on a standard savings account and put it into a cash ISA. Cash ISA, flexible cash ISA. Remember those words. Put your money in there and then you get to keep the what you'd lose to tax as well, and you'll get an even better rate. So
all right, then. Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you, Lee. That is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon,
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can X us, tweet us, whatever it's called, at This Is Money. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.